And it's my pleasure to introduce Ian Herbert from the Loughborough University Business School. He teaches in accounting and financial management, but prior to joining higher education, he had extensive experience in accounting and general management roles in industry. And he's particularly in his research looking at the evolving role of the finance function, and in particular, and the role of shared service centres. And you see the title of the talk for this afternoon, and on the programme, it actually missed off the last interesting words, because it talked about the maintaining employability for the martini workers. It missed off the last line in the hourglass profession. So I look forward to learning more about the hourglass profession. So over to you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Now, middle of the afternoon, there was a very early lunch. It's that time, isn't it? So I'm going to try and make it as team and interactive as I can. If you want to shout out questions as we go through, if anything that's not clear, as long as it's not too deeply philosophical or something requires too long an answer, quite happy to take questions as we go through. So, Bob just mentioned a little typo on the agenda. I've got one on the first slide as well, because it says project supported by SEMA. Very grateful to SEMA for supporting this project. However, sort of in the beginning, although you'll see that obviously about halfway through, around about 2002-2003, we had a SEEPCON grant from the Management Control Association. And as I was standing there drinking my coffee this morning, there was David Offley and Lisa Jack and Julia Mundy out there. First issue on the slide. So hope you'll forgive me for that, but very grateful for the support. So this is the formal agenda, and what I'm trying to do today is introduce a paper that we're working on. It's come up fairly late in the day in terms of the whole shared service project, which, as you'll see in a moment, has been going on for a little bit of time, about employability and where the role of finance and, in fact, accountants might be going in the future. But I suspect shared service centres, although they've been mentioned almost in every presentation today, I suspect for quite a few of you, you're not really sure what they are. So how many people feel fully conversant with what shared service centres are all about? And how many, is it sort of all a bit of a black box to at the moment? You've heard of them, but you're not quite sure. Right. And so in terms of business intelligence, I'm picking up that everybody's somewhere in the middle, or too shy to put their hand up or something. Right, so what I'm going to do, this project has been sort of torturing me for years on end, and I don't see why I should let you get away without having a little bit of torture too. So I'm going to start at the very beginning and work through the development of a business transformation project, the big company, the way it affected management accounting, and the way that it moved into shared service centres. That will set the ground as to what a shared service centre is all about, and then we'll look at the specific employability issues. So,
I'll just play you a little soundtrack, if I may. And when I play this to my students, it lasts about 5 minutes, and I make an excuse to go out, and I come back after exactly 7 minutes, and they get 2 minutes of the follow-on article. So you'll see why in a moment, and they hate me for it, but here we go.
Leader, someone who was in that moderate Tory tradition, but someone who was applying that moderate Tory tradition to the specific problems of our society now.
Good. Well, look, give us some big picture themes then. What do you see as the, let's get intellectual, shall we, Michael? What's the intellectual influence on him? What is the big idea that Cameron brings to bear?
I think that it's always tempting to be intellectual at 8:15 in the morning, but the crucial thing, I think, about what David wants to do is to ensure that we recognise the problems that big, centralised, out-of-touch government have created for this country, and we ensure that we empower individuals civil society and those organisations that can develop human-sized responses to our problems in order to deal with them. So in my field of education, rather than having a drift towards bigger schools, rather than having a centralised control which has led to the devaluation of our examinations and the dumbing down of our curriculum, we want to ensure that there is a greater diversity in the type of schools that people can send their children to, and that those schools have the smaller class sizes, the higher quality of teaching, and the firmer discipline that people want. And the way to achieve that, and we know that it's succeeded in other countries which are forward-looking, like Sweden, America, and Canada, is by decentralizing power.
Decentralizing power. There's a phrase that has been used, and maybe you can explain it, because I'm not sure I understand it, the post-bureaucratic age. What does this mean? What is this in practical terms as a policy of David Cameron?
The post-bureaucratic age is a way of describing what we all know, which is that in the 20th century, it was the case that bureaucracies tried to regulate and control everything from the centre. But given the way in which information has now been dispersed, given the way in which power is now in the hands of consumers in every realm, we can't have a government that attempts to run everything from the centre.
But you're always saying that. What's different about that from Thatcherism? That was what you always said.
Gets us back to
the retro nature.
No, not at all. One of the crucial things is that, as you'll appreciate, if you look at, for example, the nature of broadcasting in the past was controlled by a few people at the heart of a bureaucracy, channel controllers, who were able to decide what the whole nation watched at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the evening. Now, thanks to Sky Plus, thanks to the way in which all of us can decide what it is that we want to watch, when we want to watch it, thanks to TiVo, broadcasting has become something where power has been decentralized. The internet has ensured that you and I can access information about schools, hospitals, about medical conditions, about examinations, that mean that you and I can say to the head teacher of our local secondary school, why aren't you offering the examinations which are rigorous, which they're offering in a school down the road or in the neighbouring county or in the neighbouring country? Information has been so dispersed, individuals are now more empowered, that we have to ensure that public services make that change.
And so in
far
terms
from
of
it being retro, it's actually
it's
an
new.
Acknowledgement
Sounds
of how
new.
Technology has changed the world and also how expectations have risen.
Google Nation. Right. Just one very quick one then. What does it mean for the health service, for example?
It means that increasingly we're going to have people in control of the information about their own conditions, capable of asking professionals to act on their behalf, and crucially, that we will have hospitals judged by a whole range of outcomes which patients and GPs will use to make decisions rather than the centre decreeing abstract targets which confine professionals to a very, very narrow set of measurements.
Michael Gove, we'll be trying to put flesh on all of these ideas through the week. Thank you very much for joining us.
Not at all, Evan. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
The time now, 22 minutes past 8. British students are far worse at spelling than their foreign counterparts. That's the finding of a study of final year work at Imperial College London. So what does that tell us, if anything, about the students' ability? The study was carried out by Bernard Lamb, who's Emeritus Reader in Genetics at Imperial. He's also a former president of the Queen's English Society. Jack Bovell is chair of the Spelling Society. It's in favour of simplifying English spelling, and both are here with me in the studio. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Bernard Lamb, tell us first, when you looked at this comparison between British students and foreign students, what you found.
I didn't just look at spelling. I looked at punctuation, grammar, confusions of words, and I found in three particular pieces of work that I monitored closely for genetics and for English that the overseas students averaged 18 errors, different kinds of errors, whereas the home students average 52, which is three times the number of errors. And quite a lot of these errors affected the sense. It affected the science. So they weren't trivial errors.
What would you put it down to?
The students in Great Britain not getting enough specific, explicit teaching of spelling, grammar and punctuation, not being motivated to take it seriously, and not being consistently corrected, if they're ever corrected. One student said that I was the first lecturer who had ever corrected her English, and she was actually grateful.
Do we have a problem, Jack Bovell, do you think? Sounds like we do.
There is a problem, but first of all, the Spelling Society's...
Right, I think you've got the gist there. No, I don't make myself too popular with that, and every time I play it I get sort of 20, 30 emails the next week saying I've heard I'm going to fail if I can't write English or something, and yes, I have to deal with that. However, we will come back to that because it's quite pertinent to what we're going to say. So, the first story, what is it all about? Centralisation, decentralisation. Tories over here, Gordon Brown over there, and of course, you couldn't argue with any of that, could you? You couldn't say, well, we shouldn't let people decide, we shouldn't let local managers decide. But then, of course, you know, if you won't go many days before there's someone in the paper, you know, wife, say, dying of cancer or something, if they lived 5 miles away, she would get the treatment because that particular health authority prescribes her sort of. Of course, the argument there is, it needs to be fair. We need to have one system, one rule for the whole country. So everything oscillates between these two extremes. And it's an awkward one to crack. This is how the project started, the empowerment challenge. Went along to a SEMA branch meeting one night at a local power station, and this is what the management accountant said. If we do our job properly, there won't be any need for a separate management accounting department. The objective, to create what they call resource consciousness at the point of resource consumption. In other words, every engineer was going to be their own finance manager. They would be able to make decisions at 3 o'clock in the morning as to whether to change the pump or not. Not only in terms of engineering decisions, but also in terms of understanding the financial implications of those decisions. So that was the hypothesis, if you like. Management accountants are going to be out of a job once they've designed the system. Did it happen? So, no. So, according to the book Karl Popper, that was a nice falsifiable statement. It was falsified. And you can see, particularly into industry, it was solely your management accountants looking at that graphically. So, of course, you can do two things then. One is you can change the theory, and of course, that would fit quite nicely with your skilling thesis. As the knowledge economy grows and things get faster and a richer information environment is created, you need more and more people, clever people, to be able to understand it, management accountants. But of course, I'm too stubborn for that. So I thought to myself, well, why don't we wait, give it 10 years or so, and change the data set? Yes? Get some data that fits the theory. So, there's the power station, and the context of the company originally was in the public sector, the drumbeat, safety, availability, reliability, basically, keep the lights on. And what you can't see there are the customers. That's one single plant, technology beyond my capability. I think management accounting terms is relatively straightforward. But of course, if you go back at night, then you can see hundreds of thousands of customers. And each one of those light bulbs is a billing point. Each one of those has customer transactions, etc. In other words, it becomes a very complicated business. And I like this quote from Winston Churchill, and I think that's part of the theme for me this afternoon. So, 1990, company privatised. It was all about shrinking down to a core, getting rid of all the deadwood to some extent, but also concentrating on what they were good at. And here we are. This was the Margaret Thatcher ideology of the time. What you didn't hear Michael Gove talking about was marketisation, market testing, competitive bidding. It's all about centralisation and information now. Slight change of the message, but there we are. It was about outsourcing, cultural change, and the assumption was economic rationality. And of course, other influences at the time, Kaplan and Norton, the management accountants, but across the company, Charles Handy, virtual organisation, the Donut, focusing on core activities, the Shamrock, core part-time outsourced workers, and then the Portfolio Career, and we'll get to that. So this is what's driving their mindset. Not more than a deep theory, but you know, they've got a vision of where they wanted to go. So there's the Shamrock, and the company was all about reducing down to that professional core of workers. And the term I tend to use here is contingent workers. So 1998, what they'd done by then is to bust up this big sort of edifice into a dozen or so power stations and one or two other businesses. And it was very much a sort of Darwinian fight for survival. The weak were going down, it was a case of shape up or ship out sort of thing. And again, a lot of theory driving some of the things, it was a case of empowering the engineers, telling you get on with things, and the truth is what works. This is a sort of Will James pragmatism. So a whole raft of new working practices coming in, and perhaps there's a sort of Schumpeterian created destruction. And one or two of these power stations did get sold off, and others got mothballed, and some just closed down. So what they were trying to do is to find a balance between where they'd started off, centralised, bureaucratic structure, it was all about efficiency, and they wanted to be over here in the sort of new age. So the pendulum was swinging, which way round? To the right, that way. But it wasn't a smooth journey. Two steps forward sometimes, one step back. And it was even more complicated than that. I mean, if you take three of the dimensions, this is from Fruit, Martinson and Ogden. At any one time, it wasn't a case of lurching this way or lurching that way. They were at a point. It was about finding the right point from that point. So it was moving this way or moving that way. And so that might be moving that way as that comes back a little bit. And you could almost see a sort of music technician, sound mixer, sliding the sliders about to get the optimal mix. But not perhaps too new, 1982, Peters & Mortimer really talked about simultaneous loose type properties. And levers of control model, Simons, again, he used in 2005 this idea of a number of sliders that management would tweak. So what they've got here is visibility of the business in terms of the bottom line, what it was producing. But what they didn't know was what was happening inside the business. It was sort of Latourian black box. 2002, the engineer-based initiatives were starting to run out of steam. What they then did was to put the company back together again, initially with light technologies, gas and coal, bigger role in the head office. They started to buy other electricity companies, the distributors again, so they started to put the industry back together again. So it was about identifying best practice and moving forward, looking more for efficiency rather than here. Effectiveness. And then this is where we get into the shared service centre. They set up a shared service centre which ran across the individual sites but also ran across into the regulated businesses, which had to be kept at arm's length for regulation purposes, so that the government could see whether it was efficient or not. But the shared service centre could go across both of them. And we have to admit, and we'll hold our hands upon this, the shared service centre had started off in around 1999, 2000. Originally, it was a case of the CEO said, why don't we outsource the accounting function? They'd fought a rearguard action on that, but what they had conceded is that there were some efficiencies in terms of doing payroll for two or three sites, and then four sites and five sites. So they started off very small, and that's why we really didn't spot it. By the time we got to 2004, there was a couple of hundred people, and they were doing the back office, or more of the back office things, such as purchase ledger, credit control, what have you. So
couple of papers out last year on that. I won't dwell on them, other than to say, again, within the overall context of this journey, it was a slow evolution. They moved from a blame culture here to a no blame culture to a slow to blame culture. These are lovely euphemisms, aren't they? But you know, you've got a site manager who was involved in everything, and it was a bit like the headmaster, and you know, he'd take engineers aside in public and just give them a dressing down in the plant and what have you. That sort of largely disappeared, where you can't have empowerment. But yeah, it went quite a way over here, and then it started to pull back. Assumption of trust, quality seen as antitrust, and then we got trust and Sarbanes-Oxley. So it became a much more bureaucratic environment anyway, but it didn't seem to undermine the basic principles of the empowerment. By having sort of tighter justification systems, the engineers felt that although, as long as they justified it, they'd got as much operational flexibility as they had before. And I interpreted that using the Simon's levers of control. I won't sort of dwell on that, but I think you've got the slide if you want to get involved in it. In 2007, the relative size of these areas here gives a sort of feel for the diversity of things. It wasn't a sort of homogenous approach. There were a lot of variations within it. Another way of looking at it, and I think your question to the last speaker was the politics. Started off assuming that everything was going to be economically rational, but of course you've got a power play in all this. If you say take the management accountants as these sort of nodes here, and they're all sort of interconnected, and you overlay the engineers as a sort of political body over the top, then you've got a period of time, and this is over years, where they're having a turf war, basically. The engineers don't want to give up their control and their domain. It is the kingdom of engineering. The accountants want to get more involved as business partners, but also to understand more of what is going on, bring more financial discipline in. And so you've got lots of interactions there. Knowledge of systems and structures, theories of action, and it's negotiated bit by bit all the way through. Now, shared services, the Cinderella of the plot, a range of possibilities, and perhaps instead of this lurch one way or the other way, maybe, again, to coin the political term, maybe the third way. So what's the shared service centre all about? Well, if that's the sort of multi-divisional form and you've got these service departments here within each business unit, then what you do is you take all those bits out and you move them into one shared service centre with a service level agreement to each one of these business units. And then you have a reporting line to head office. So what you've got here, and this is the difference between a sort of head office centralisation and the true ethos of the shared service centre, is it's semi-autonomous, it's thinking like a business, it has its own investment plan, which is independent of the operating units. But it's there to support them, it's there to help them, but obviously to do that at least cost. Lots of definitions about that's one. I have no idea what a management structure designed to promote value generation is, but it sounds wonderful, doesn't it? I don't know. So, internal customers. So, there's a lot of semantics around this, and they can be hollow, but they can be meaningful. So, it's about customers, it's about competing in the open market, because people can say, well, I don't have a choice, I've got to use the
shared service centre, it's an internal monopoly. On the other hand, shared service centre people would say, well, we're benchmarking with the outside world. You could go and outsource the whole lot if you wanted. So we are in an open market position, even if it's not with you, Mr. Business Unit. And what is and isn't a shared service centre, I think you just have to say, if it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck, then it probably is a duck. But we've seen a vast array of permutations here. So, the options of what to do and not to do, this is where this company started off, by trying to embed financial discipline and the thinking about financial discipline within the engineers, where you could have specialist team members. They used to have a heat accountant, although a bit like the French and German model, that was always an engineer. Well, the divisional function, that was the traditional MAs. The shared service centre there, or could be outsourced at the other end. So, this was knowing how to do things. At this end, it's knowing sufficient to be able to negotiate the contract. And of course, if you want to get into the theory there, transaction cost economics would suggest that if it's cheaper to avoid all those contract costs and be over here, that's where you should be. But if you can minimise the transaction costs, even with an external party, then you should be over there. So, in this particular company, over time, funnily enough, engineering was no longer the core function. If you wanted to string a pylon, put it across the field, you could get a number of firms in to do it. What started to define the company was the ability to manage a bundle of engineering projects and deal with the customers. And who was doing that? The shared service centre, along with the call centre. So it actually, the donut organisation, well, wasn't quite how I think Handy had intended it, but they actually flipped the whole thing around. And of course, you can see the shared service centre in a number of ways. One view might be as a set of routines with its own intellectual property, and in fact, in the last 2 or 3 years, one or two shared service centres have actually been sold to outsourced providers for serious sums of money, and then the services rented back. But of course, now the company was really an energy trading company. This one had the ability to generate its own power, but if you think about the people who knock on your doors trying to sell you electricity and gas of an evening, half of those companies don't actually have their own electricity. They buy it on the open market and just deliver it to your door. So the kingdom of engineering was challenged and management accounting was strengthened. And to give you an idea of where the shared service centre finished up for this company, you don't need to read all of that, but you can see that it's big. It's now a couple of thousand people. 1.2 million finance transactions per year. Managing lots of vehicles, 17,000 colleagues paid, and the other thing they're doing here is using the shared service centre as a change management vehicle. So £65 million worth of change, however you measure change in that sort of thing. But also, crucially, delivery of the UK Enterprise Resource Planning System. And when we first started off, that was the mind map of it. It's got a little bit more complicated there nowadays, but we're still working our way through these aspects and more aspects such as employability, the role of finance are coming through. So we've got about 10 cases, or we've grown with a couple more just recently, and what I want to do now is to focus on three of them, Oyoko, Anko, and Farmco 1, to look at particularly international issues and the role of accounting and the role of knowledge workers. So this is the paper. There's the abstract in your pack, but there will be a full paper
out, and we're setting up a website for the project in the next couple of weeks. The address is on the abstract. If you go to that, say, just give us 2 or 3 weeks, you'll be able to download the full paper if you wish. So, cover that up. Yes? You ever seen something like that before? What's the caption say? Middle there. No, if only it was. Yes, if only it was the map from Britain. Yes. Now, this looks a bit politically incorrect, except that it was given to me by a shared service centre in Poland.
Because they think it's quite funny.
Now, to get all theoretical about it, time-space distanciation, Quatrain and Hopper, basically, with the right information communication technology, the right ERP systems, all these jobs can be done elsewhere. This is what enables the global knowledge economy. Trouble is, the only person who has to be in that particular location, say down the end of our road, is the bloke from Poland. All the rest of them can be in Poland. Now, this isn't good news for UK PLC, is it? So, we coined the term the martini workers, the knowledge workers of tomorrow, today, anytime, any place, anywhere. Do you all remember that? Well, you don't look that old, but I'm glad that you do. Okay, so this is what we're trying to do with this particular project. And we saw some quite serious issues. So, we did some further field work, particularly concentrated on these three companies. Banco, a large European bank, and already got shared services in India, mainly transactions, that's where 1,000 people work. But the centre in Poland was much more interesting to us because they were going up the value chain into higher level work, particularly legal work. So, went over to Warsaw, and of course, what the guy tells you over there, and this is a British guy over there, is that the reason that they're out there is not only because it's cheap and flexible in terms of accommodation, but they're a good graduates.
Yes, well, they've got better English skills than what they can recruit in the UK, yes? And they speak another 2 or 3 languages fluently. And are good technically at those languages. And when you're doing legal documentation, you can't use text speak. Yeah? You can't say no. Precise.
And there are other things about Poland, such as a bit of trivia there. Because of the communist regime, everybody is in the record system. That is everybody born after the last 10 years. And so your fiduciary issues are a lot less. So, fast forward to London. This was the view out of this guy's window, or near enough. So this was the legal services director who was a customer of the shared service centre. And also, when the interview was sort of fixed up, I probably wasn't listening. I expected him to have hundreds of people. And he'd actually got about 30. But, you know, these are high-flying sort of legal people. And look at that, he's got 5 in India, 5 in Poland, 5 in London, 3 or 4 freelance, 5 or 6 at a third party company. This really is a sort of salami approach to getting the job done. But he knows everyone, and it's about quality, language, and education. So, a couple of quotes, I won't read those out. But, there's a big, smart fan. But it's a drift. It's a bit like that of the utility code case. You know, just moving from one end, from 30 people that were all employed full time in London to a more outsourced model, just slowly. And at each decision point,
But, and we can all see that it's just about cost, and cost will rise in India, and so we're okay, carry on as normal. But I don't think we'll get the attitude or the application. You know, it's a good job for people, good potential career moves. So, you know, they acknowledge this mixed sourcing. Of course, putting all this stuff overseas, you think, would be a big risk. Not a bit of it. It's actually given them better control, because by putting it out, they've had to think very carefully about the processes, re-engineer them, and get proper documentation in place. So they see outsourcing, offshoring, is actually reducing risk. You know, retrospectively, I suspect. And also, maybe it's a global team, global process. They want to be a global bank, expanding their horizons. So, it's not. We're not great at doing that. This is the documentation, frankly. That's not what our people feel they're paid for. So, offshoring has put more controls in place. And what they're trying to do with Poland is move from this sort of lights out processing of millions of checks up to high value stuff, preparing slides for analysts to go and see customers with, preparing legal documentation, etc. Now, went to Singapore, interviewed this guy's opposite number out there. Certain issues about putting things into shared services there, particularly Japan is particularly different, but in Singapore, in Australia, they're moving work to Poland. But obviously they've got a bit more to think about in terms of time zone. Little employability concerns because of the Singapore market. Went to Hong Kong a couple of weeks ago, interviewed the equivalent legal director over there in one of those towers there. They look different in the daylight. Now, they're moving stuff to the shared service center component too, but what he tells me is that other banks there are moving things into China. There's the manufacturing wing moves inland, and they're filling in with high-tech research jobs at the back of it, then that's the new frontier for shared service. And another interesting thing, Martini workers, US expats, extremely expensive packages. They were now being sent home after the financial credit crunch and being replaced with local people. And there the shared service centre had now got a big corporate steer. You had to sort of unbundle yourselves from all these little freelance arrangements and put things into the shared service centre. So it had become, from a very piecemeal operation, a big plank of their strategy going forward. Okay, Formco. Now, here's a FTSE 100 company. All this stuff here, this is their core business. They don't do it. They outsource that lot to universities. A lot of the research. What do they keep in-house? Well, the business process services that support all that. So again, a little bit company on its head. Interesting thing there is that they'd split the shared services into two. This is the transaction stuff. And this is the higher level corporate services. So if you want a maternity form, you go here. But after they've got so many maternity forms that don't seem to fit circumstances, it's accelerated up to the higher level, and they deliver, diagnose, and design a new solution. So what we did with them was we tried to map their different processes in shared services onto this grid. And they were quite keen on keeping it in-house, but they were identifying that things in this box down here could well one day be outsourced. So there we are, the higher level work, that sort of business partnering role at the top end. Now, the third case is one, you can all imagine the names, aren't they? Oil Co. Now, this guy is even more disparaging of turning out about universities. hourglass is because business processing has redesigned the job into end-to-end processes, such as hire to fire. It's all programmed, it's all relatively straightforward. You've now got spans of control that are very high, 1 to 50, 1 to 100. What's your chance of getting through that promotion?
And it's all about being competitive. If you're a finance graduate in Manila, you've got to be working on a three-shift basis. But he's saying, well, we're completely honest with them. They're maybe not going to get progression with the company because of the way it works, but we'll give them an experience. And that's what one of the interviewees said to him. I'll take the job because I want the professional skills. I really don't have a choice. I'll do whatever you say. And part of the issue there is to actually manage their work to stop them working 60, 70 hours a week. So, a little bit sobering, so just looking at some of the implications then. You're not all depressed, are you, at the moment? You'll be nodding heads. Now, in the econometric studies, they talk about middle-level occupations disappearing, but they're not finding that in practice. So there's the hourglass. I think it makes more sense if you invert it, and you see everyone fighting to get to the top. So you've got the elite workers facing business. You've got BPR squeezing the middle. You've got very flat hierarchies down here, and it's very difficult to get through the middle. And the other thing is, when you've run out of these, when they've retired, where do you get more from? Business process re-engineering. So, and the other thing that's happening here is these are being redefined as processes cutting across disciplines, hire to fire, purchase to pay. In other words, the professions in there are being deinstitutionalized. Yes? Perhaps you won't have personnel professionals or accounting professionals, you'll just have admin managers who will see the whole thing as an admin job and not feel the need to be affiliated to a professional body as we think of them now. Now, perhaps even more dramatic, here's the SEMA version of this. Shared Service Centre Automated, the basic stuff at the bottom, the nuts and bolts. But what happens when this has all gone overseas or has gone up to some cheap part of the country? Here's your stuff down here in the southeast, the clever bit. Then, how do people get from here to here? And maybe you don't need to do all this to actually do these things. In which case, perhaps you don't need qualified management accountants. Management accounting is still important, still crucial, we've heard a lot of that today, but do you need management accountants to do that stuff? Another one from SEMA. These are these business processing skills, business processing, business partnering skills, and the core F&A, finance and accounting skills. What happens if that has gone overseas? If there isn't a training route through it. Again, it starts to beg the question, well, does that collapse at the top? Or do other people with other skills come into that professional space? So, perhaps if you look at management accounting in the first case utility code, some of it's going into the self-service, the embedding into and embodying into employees, and some of it going to the shared service centre, the old divisional function is becoming hollowed out.
And we're back there, as Seymour mentioned, to Simon et al. 1954 and Sapp 1982. You know, these are real issues, I think, for today. So, what are management accountants doing? Well, we see a role that buyers and sellers of accounting services within the company, and you need perhaps different skills and outlooks for that. Another way of looking at it, and I won't bore you with all of this, to see the little bit of time questions. Score making, this is the business partnering aspect up there. Score keeping, the specialism in financial reporting. And perhaps we've heard in the last speaker talk about being able to do both, perhaps. Well, that's that area up there. How does the firm do that? So you don't want to be down here. Nobody wants to be there. You want to be up there somewhere. But what is that professional territory? And whose professional territory is it? And so, again, we can look at the hierarchy of skills. We can talk about moving up the food chain. You can look at it in terms of the knowledge requirements and the management support roles. There again, Herbert Simon, 50 years ago, but not far away. Feedback, scorekeeping, attention directing. That's the bit, outsourced shared service centre. That's where the tacit people-centred knowledge, around the business intelligence and you know, getting your handle on the people, that's up there. And what are you doing with management? Well, it's about feed forward. That is the sort of centre of excellence, business partnering. That's the architectural knowledge of the firm. So, yes, a few challenges. Any comments? Does this have a resonance with people, or am I absolutely barking mad this afternoon? Well, clearly down here, Johnny, so. Yes?
I'm assuming that what you're saying is that I was sure so should be essentially de-skilled for other jobs in marketing or elsewhere. A lot of the talks we've had today emphasise the need for the finance function to be very much connected with the strategy and the business people who are doing this, because we're doing it completely. Although you might be able to do that at a higher level than I think I'm doing that. The other thing is the share service only serving one. The Scottish Government lesson decided that shared services might be used for the public sector, and thinking that it's a shed with all these people servicing the whole of a completely different organisation,
yeah.
Thinking that might work.
Right, okay, to take the last point, is this just a cross-border company? In the private sector, that is the model, essentially. There are one or two exceptions, but in the public sector, it's about combining, say, four or five health trusts or councils or something, or perhaps the university and health trusts and things like that. Now, the whole point about the, and you know, some of this isn't just shared services, and I'm not saying they're a good thing, I'm not saying they're a bad thing, I'm just saying it's happening and there are potential implications. But the whole point about it is that it is driving a standardised, facilitating, perhaps a better word, a standardisation agenda. So the point you make about these are different businesses with different cultures and what have you, well, that's true. They've got to standardise. And it's no use saying, well, my customers are different, they want to do this in a different way, because guess what? They're going to be using the same ERP system as you. So the date's got to go there, and the fact's got to go there, and the total's got to go there, and what have you, because it's all the same. So we're moving into homogenous processes, in which case, it's up to the people in the business to adapt. Now, I'm not saying that should happen, I'm not saying it's right, I'm not saying it's wrong, but I think to answer your question, that is what is tending to happen. There is less and less opportunity to say, I'm different, I want to do my own thing, you've got to put your accounting system around me. Which again, means that you're taking out some of that added value of the accountant being close to the business and understanding those nuances. It is becoming a homogenised world. OK.
can't remember the first question, but that probably answers both, does it? Potentially. So, very, very quickly, the employability, the ability of an individual to get the job they want or to keep the job they've got. Employability is the cutting edge of career, because if you're not employable now and you haven't got a job and you can't get a job, well, guess what? You ain't got a career. But it's now a function, as we saw with the oil co. It's about skills, particularly English, location, perhaps moving to wherever, price, and performance. So you are in a competitive world as a knowledge worker with anybody, anywhere, anytime, any place, who might be undercutting you or overperforming you. Yes? So that again, you know, we've tended to see UK PLC as this vibrant knowledge economy, but of course it is a little bit ephemeral, isn't it? I'm being provocative. Questions?
Phil Pickering from Rolls-Royce. I think that was very interesting observations and resonate very much with the things we're trying to achieve in Rolls-Royce. The centres of competence, creating the business decision support level is our big challenge, and how we manage that and avoid the risk of losing the business understanding with the business partner becoming maybe the self-service information with the chief exec rather than the business partner from finance. So any thoughts on how that risk is mitigated?
Well, I think in terms of Rolls-Royce, having seen the shared service centre one aspect of that is the percentage of the population of a professional discipline that's in the shared service. So accounting currently has about 15% of the shared service centre. HR have gone the other way and have got about over 50% their professionals in the HR shared services. So there's a very different feel when you talk to the to managers of those centres as to what they're trying to achieve. Now the accounting department, after my own heart on this one, is seeing it as a business support operation. The HR people, and I think Mark would disagree with it, but I think he would support this, it is about the self-service.
I agree with you. We actually want to move further in the finance side, so we want to move into the business decision support.
Yeah, so that exactly is what Oil Co are trying to do now, to get those people that report to the business managers into a sort of matrix system, so that they're in a team, but they're probably reporting to two or three regional directors, but still within the finance function. This gets us into the whole sort of Simon Sack debate as to whether, if they're in the business, they might go native. And that's what happened with another Oil Co Shell. They pushed the reserves a bit too hard, and the whole thing came crashing down to about 20% of market capitalisation, around about 2000. And they are very keen to avoid that situation. Part of the reason for pulling them out of the business so they can't go native, but they're still working on the mechanism. So I'm happy to talk about that.
Good afternoon, Ben Freeman, independent consultant. I lost the flow of logic in one slide. And that was your nice graph of entrepreneurial versus bureaucratic and trust versus not trust. And my observation in the last 10 years is that the opposite has happened, that we have a lot less trust rather than more trust. And that's why we want to regularise the banks. That's why we talk about Sarbanes-Oxley. Nobody trusts anything. So we have to put lots of bureaucracy around it. And I would have said organisations are much more bureaucratic than they were 15 years ago, because we don't have that trust that you assume that we now have got more of. It creates a nice onwards and upwards chart, but I would challenge
it. Yes, okay. I think it works on a sort of number of levels. I think the market and society trust companies less. They see companies as a black box and are worried about the sphere.
stewardship issues, but I think within companies, then to get more responsible working, there has been a move towards a more trusting environment between colleagues and team working and what have you, but those controls have had to strengthen that trust, if you like. But from this company at least, the engineers, whereas one would be expecting them to be railing against it and saying, well, this is just back to the bureaucracy again, we've had all that 20 years ago, they're actually finding that with a well-designed scheme, they've got the space within the parameters, the boundary controls, to operate, and that doesn't seem to be a problem for them. I mean, I suspect a colleague over there from Society of the Marketing People, trust is still a high part of your business, isn't it? And that's not changing. It's the type of business. So I think there is a sort of business specific there sometimes.
Maybe we're going to have to call a halt. That's generated interesting discussions. I think maybe people might want to discuss with you over coffee and so on. We'll need to finish now. I'll thank you in a moment. Just to say that we have coffee or tea upstairs on the second floor, and we're due to start here back promptly at 4:30. So I'd like to thank you for your attention.